Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This week, what's behind the spate of mass shootings in South Africa as police hunt the gunmen who went on killing sprees in bars and taverns? Communities are reeling, angry at police for failing to curb high levels of violent crime.
We'll see by their actions because we no longer believe what they say.
Also, he ruled Angola for nearly four decades. José Eduardo dos Santos leaves behind a complicated legacy. His supporters say he was an architect of peace who left an indelible mark on African politics. His critics say he was repressive, ruthless, and corrupt. As Angolans prepare to head to the polls, we look at how dos Santos shaped that country's society and politics. Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you so much for joining me. Communities in South Africa are trying to come to terms with a series of mass shootings that has gripped the country and made worldwide headlines. The flow of illegal guns in the country and the government's inability to get high rates of violent crime under control is a hot button topic. Police have launched a manhunt for the perpetrators of recent violent crimes and have made several arrests, but affected communities say they simply don't trust law enforcement to bring the criminals to justice.
Police are hunting five gunmen who burst into a bar in Soweto and killed 15 customers in a hail of bullets, South Africa's police minister has said. Becky Kelly described the incident in the early hours of Sunday morning as such a brutality. He said the high number of rounds forensics teams found at the scene meant the killers would have had to reload in the middle of the slaughter.
There were about plus 130 empty cartridges of AK-47, which means those people that were there were really meant business of killing.
Nine people were also wounded in the attack in the Johannesburg Township's Orlando East neighborhood. LA said police did not yet know the motive, but that he guaranteed the assailants would be found. South Africa has one of the world's highest murder rates. Nevertheless, the shooting and two others at the weekend have shocked the nation. Police say four people were killed at a tavern in Pietermaritzburg late on Saturday, and two more during a suspected robbery at another bar in Katlehong, outside Johannesburg. The three attacks, which are not believed to be linked, have unleashed anger at the police for failing to tackle high levels of violent crime. LA pledged extra officers in Orlando East for door-to-door searches and more police vehicles. This was resident Andiswa Nyambane's response.
We'll see by their actions because we no longer believe what they say.
Around 20,000 people are murdered in South Africa every year, out of a population of about 60 million. Campaign group Gun Free South Africa says there are around 3 million guns registered in the country, with many more thought to be circulating on the black market.
And that was David Doyle of Reuters with that report. And here's some of the reaction we received from the shootings from South Africans on the streets of Johannesburg.
What worries me the most about the shootings in South Africa is the police systems. I'm worried about our police officers who don't patrol our areas. The shootings, they were there because there was no police van. And then we can't stop having fun because people are shooting. They choose to kill other people. So police officers should start working because we pay tax for those vans to be on the street to patrol and protect the citizens. So if there is no police visibility, every time crime is going to be repeated. reported. So the minister must explain to us, what are those guys doing? Are they, because we see them jolting every day, dating with girls or eating lunch. I've never seen a police officer running to a criminalist. Oh, it's always communities who have to solve crime every day. So that is why we die, because we are not trained to be police officers, but we solve crime. So police officers must be in the community. We pay tax for them to be in the community and to patrol the community. Then the shootings won't be visible. That's my giving to the shootings in the taverns in our community.
For me, I didn't like what really transpired, because it's not making us feel safe. Even if you want to go out, you have some fun, you've got a birthday celebration, now you're no longer comfortable to take yourself anyway, because you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if maybe the owner of the tavern is the one who's got issues with the people from outside, or it's the outside people who are just trying to rob people of their lives. And this is not safe in our day-to-day living. So, it's really freaking and stressing. People are losing their loved ones, and it's so sad and so touching. We are just coming from this COVID era, now the shootings and everything. It's really not safe for the people.
The thing that I don't like here in South Africa is because the people from outside, they are here to kill us. They are not here to make collaboration with us. Even myself, I'm a car guard here on the station street. So sometimes I'm afraid, because I think maybe they will come and shoot me. And I'm an innocent person. Sometimes I'm afraid to come here to do my job because of them. I think my president must take them back to where they belong. That is my problem that I have in my heart and in my mind also.
It's worse. It's worse.
Why is it?
To see somebody die for nothing. Innocent people are dying for nothing. So it's terrible, man. It's so terrible.
Do you have faith in our police?
I cannot say I have faith in our police, because some of the police, they are taking churches. Some of them. Not all of them, they are good. But most of them, they are corrupt. Definitely they are corrupt.
I'm not feeling confidence with them. Because anything is possible, even if they are there, even if they are included, they can be conducted. There is nothing that they don't play any role.
Well, joining me now to discuss the crime situation in South Africa is Eldred de Klerk. He's a policing and social conflict specialist and a principal associate at the Africa Center for Security and Intelligence Praxis. Eldred, thank you so much for being here with me on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Adi.
Eldred, we just heard people there really express frustration with police. Very little faith in law enforcement. And, you know, I say that with a little bit of confidence because, of course, you know, you and I come from the same part of the country. We come from the same country. And as I want to point to a survey by the Human Sciences Research Council last year that showed there's very little or very low public confidence in the police in the country. It's dipped to something around a level of 27%. And this survey cites two examples for people's low confidence, two high-profile examples, the Marikana massacre in which police killed 34 minors during a wildcat strike, and, of course, the 2021 social unrest, which saw in KwaZulu-Natal last year, in which around 300 people died. And just how poorly police handled those situations. How would you describe the relationship, Eldred, between police and the South African public right now?
Thank you. Well, the surveys are correct. Those two examples are but two examples. And yes, public confidence and trust in the police is low. I know that police senior management and the ministry has been trying to engage publics and understand how this public confidence can be grown. And part of that is that there's bad crime scene management, the low conviction rates, which tends to, as far as public perception is, give rise to people acting with impunity. The difficulty we're sitting with here is that the police is burdened with the ills, the social, political, and economic ills that basically has devastated the South African economy and has made sure that most people continue to live in poverty. So it's the socioeconomic conditions which has to be addressed urgently, and it's public confidence across government departments that unfortunately is low, including that of the social justice cluster, sorry, the justice cluster, which includes the police. So it's a general confidence or lack of confidence and trust in government's ability to respond to the plight of the people.
And of course, Eldred, you know, especially in certain parts of the country where there are low-income neighborhoods, there is this long-standing tension between police and law enforcement, and dates back to the apartheid era. And of course, as you mentioned, people's perceived this perception that the government's unable to fix the crime problem. How does South Africa fare against other countries in the world when it comes to cracking down on violent crime? I mean, what do the global headlines get right about South Africa, and what do they get wrong?
Well, what they get wrong is they tend to think that all of South Africa is burning all at any one time. Yes, the impact of violent crime, of course, is devastating. And it basically terrifies and causes alarm across the community and across the country. And this should be reported on. However, South African ordinary citizens are resilient. They work terribly hard. They still act as neighbors. And they still have a belief that South Africa, and maybe if not the continent of Africa, can resolve its own problems. So the promise of a democratic South Africa in which all of us participate freely and live freely is definitely still in our hearts and our minds. It is going to mean that we need to change the global nature of how we do politics and the global nature of how do we do business, so that we can actually pay more attention to those who need and those who are in need, and to make sure that we basically ensure that everybody's quality of life is improved. And South Africa's, we still have a lot of faith, and we believe that we can be global citizens and be good global citizens and be welcoming of everybody.
You know, the United States and some countries in Europe and elsewhere in the world are well known for mass shootings. How common are mass shootings in South Africa?
It's exactly because it's so rare. Yes, we have one of the highest and alarming murder rates in the country. Most of that is one-on-one. We define mass shootings where three or more people is killed in the same incident. That is rather rare. And the kind of thing we've seen in the last number of months is the rarest of it all. The alarming thing about that is that until we understand the motive and the intentions of those who are committing these killings, we won't be able to understand if they're connected. We won't be able to understand whether this is a direct challenge to the capability and capacity of government. And we won't be able to understand or answer the question whether this is yet another test following the July insurrection and unrest on the state of the South African politics.
Now, of course, we want to leave the detective work to the police, but, you know, in your assessment, Eldred, is what we're seeing, do you think there is something behind it that has to do with politics, economics, or simply just the high crime rates, or, as some news outlets have wondered, illegal guns in the country, or all of the above?
It's probably all of the above, and we hope that the alarming thing is that this is not just political, but that is not just political. That is not just an attempt to erode confidence and trust in all of government, because to arrest this, and if you would excuse the pun, is going to require an all of government response, not just the police. Every single public service department has to play their role. And the weakest part of our public service department is local government, because every single criminogenic factor that actually drives crime and violence at a local level is in the hands of local government that often has a bigger budget than any one single government department. So we need to strengthen local government, and it's also an all-of-society response. And this is where government needs to bridge the gap between its and its citizens and change the focus from government to governance, which requires active, participative citizens. To free our people up to be active citizens, we have to change the world of work. And the world of work the fact that so many people have to work overtime, they have to travel extensive distance to and from work, means that they're not able to be present in the lives of their family, their friends, their loved ones, or their community. And that is deeply concerning because they're not there at the time and place when decisions are made that affect their lives. So we have to bring the private, retail, and commercial sector on board to say, how do you ensure that the world of work, the gap between the highest paid and the lowest paid, and where and how people work has actually changed to ensure that citizens are free to be active citizens?
I almost don't want to move away from what you were just saying. Now, I'll come back to sort of reform and community policing. But what are police looking at right now? What and who are they looking at as potentially being behind these shootings? And in your view, are they already going about it in the right way?
Well, one of the things they are doing is that they're actually going to communities and sitting down and not making promises, that they are listening. And I think the anxiety of them feeling almost single-handedly responsible as a department for dealing with this is actually telling, because ministers, the national commissioner, are running from pillar to post trying to engage communities. And the message is very clear to communities that they will do work resolutely and tirelessly to do the detective work. However, they need tactical intelligence from community. They need information that will lead to preventing these incidents in the future. And this is the most concerning thing, is that government is a very bad communicator of its successes or of its needs. Because out of five incidences, if you thwart four, nobody gets to know about it. But we do get to know about the one incident that has a major impact on the lives of people and communities. So government, and I've been part of some of the government engagements in the last while, the message is that we need people to provide information, and people are providing information. It's the bravery of someone who, while something was happening, continued to roll and video what was happening at a particular tavern. And it's that footage that has led to some of the arrests that we've seen. So we don't expect citizens to put themselves in harm's way, but where they know of things, that information could, no matter how small, be part of a basket of information that leads to the identification and finally the arrest based on evidence of people. So the government engagements are going forward, the request for information is going forward, and the request for all of us to accept responsibility for our neighbor is also another message that's come from government.
Now, you spoke earlier about sort of the big picture fixes that need to happen, the economic landscape, and of course, just on the human level, how people's lives need to be improved on a daily basis. And, you know, of course, when it comes to policing itself, perception is, of course, everything. For many, it is reality. But what, in your view, are the changes and reforms, at least in the near term, that are needed to be made for effective policing in South Africa to bring, the communities on board, to bring down high crime levels and rebuild or build that public trust and confidence in law enforcement?
Well, the one thing that you can say about us South Africans is we're never short of ideas. We've got Absolutely. Really stunning policies. We have a world-class constitution. That's to be celebrated. However, we let ourselves down because we've just seen post-Marikana massacre. We've seen the Marikana Commission. We've seen the panel of experts of which I've been a part. We've seen the July unrest, and we've seen the task team that come from there. We shaped and crafted a national development plan 2030 for South Africa with very pertinent recommendations. We haven't seen the necessary public leadership that actually sees us resolutely and diligently look to implement those recommendations. Now, they may not be entirely on point, but until we implement the recommendations, look at the impact, consider whether they're making a difference, and correct if need be. Failing to implement the recommendations resolutely, I would hope, which takes public leadership and active citizens, like I said earlier, but I'm hoping that is not a sign of a lack of political will. And I don't mean political will insofar as, you know, politicians and public representatives have ill will. It's just that if you fail to act on recommendations that is already there as to how we can transform the South African Police Service, and let me say categorically, the South African Police Service cannot transform itself. It's going to need help. It's going to need that public engagement. It's going to need other public service departments to come aboard, and it's going to need clear and decisive public leadership. If we fail to implement the existing raft of recommendations we have, I think in the end, politicians and ourselves as thought leaders and public leaders will be judged, and we'll be failing public trust. And I'm hoping that we don't drop the ball and betray the public trust by not implementing those recommendations.
Just briefly, I think we've got about a minute and a half left here. Eldred, there's another side to the coin, of course, the conditions that police officers work under. What kind of training, resources and staffing do they receive? And is that a big part of the problem?
Yes, it is. We definitely have to start getting real scenario-based training for police. We need to start looking at what they resource with. And we also need to start addressing the culture of policing, to take police out of their vans, let them walk the beat, ensure that they understand that their image and public engagement, that the so-called soft skills, is just as important as the hard skills of being able to use a firearm, drive at high speeds, and react speedily to a call for service. That the effort, and every effort they make at building relationships with communities, and every courteous act they do continues to engender confidence, trust, and respect for the police. And it shows that we are mutually responsible for our shared future. If we can just through police training and police leadership and starting affecting the police culture, get that message through to every single man and woman in uniform, we will already would have done a lot to affect how effective policing is.
Excellent analysis there. Eldred de Klerk, thank you for giving us the lay of the land. Eldred is a policing and social conflict specialist. He spoke to me from Cape Town, South Africa. Eldred, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, here in the United States, communities are also reeling from a surge of recent mass shootings. Some technologists are focused on how to prevent casualties. VOA's Julia Tabo spoke with entrepreneurs who have developed gun-detecting technologies.
Boom, 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 boom. Irish gunshot.
I see dead bodies on the floor.
Gun violence in America has reached epidemic proportions.
I'm terrified. I'm really terrified.
And many Americans are fed up.
We are enraged. We are disgusted.
While the country is divided about gun rights and gun control laws, the recent mass shootings in a school, a supermarket, and at a community parade have put a spotlight on some technology that may help reduce gun deaths.
It was shortly after the Parkland school shooting, and my daughter's school started doing lockdown drills, active shooter drills. She came home really upset from it, and we said, enough's enough, something needs to be done.
The incident sparked an idea.
I saw people were doing facial recognition technology, and I was like, what if we use the existing security cameras to detect guns?
Leif's company, Zero Eyes, developed gun detection software that uses artificial intelligence to analyze data from existing security cameras to look for a gun. Once the software determines there's a gun present,
that alert is sent to our Zero Eyes Operations Center here outside of Philadelphia that staff 24/7, 365 with veterans. And then they look at it and say, is that really a gun or not? And if it's a gun, we hit dispatch and that alert goes through to our clients, and simultaneously will go to 911.
So now they have a picture of the potential shooter, the type of weapon he's holding, and where he's located.
That type of actionable intel is critical in these situations to decrease response times.
Roncocas Valley Regional High School in New Jersey was the first to implement the software.
When we had an active shooter drill with this technology, that's what really opened our eyes as to the value of Zero Eyes.
Alert from Zero Eyes, Charlie 111, subject armed with a rifle.
The school conducted an active shooter drill with the technology.
Put the gun down, put the gun down, put the gun down!
Which led them to the armed person in about 90 seconds. half the time it took in the same drill without the technology.
In these situations, it's all about minimizing the time, which minimizes casualties.
For large public venues, some have turned to Evolve Technologies gates that have scanners that use millimeter wave sensors and other technology that can detect guns and other weapons quickly, allowing thousands of people to enter a space with minimal disruption.
We use advanced technology like artificial intelligence to find and discriminate between a phone and a firearm, for example, the things you're normally carrying and something that's a real threat.
There have been more than 300 mass shootings in the U.S. so far this year. While these technologies can't guarantee the prevention of more shootings, they're among efforts to keep public spaces safe. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
Well, it's time now for a break, and when Straight Talk Africa returns, repressive, ruthless, or corrupt? Or an architect of peace who fostered Angola's post-war oil boom? We'll look at the life and legacy of former Angolan president, the late José Eduardo dos Santos. We'll be back in a moment.
Empowerment and humanity towards a better world.
Economic and social progress of every society.
Facts and information from key players rather than spectators in politics, business, science and technology.
City, rural, educated or underprivileged. We care and we listen to what matters to you.
Your voices are our voices.
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. He is credited with leading his country away from hardline Marxism and ushering in a post-war oil boom that transformed Angola. But he's also criticized for making his nation one of the poorest on earth. Former Angolan president José dos Santos died on Friday, July 8th, in Spain, where he had been living in self-imposed exile. And now there is a bitter legal battle over where dos Santos should be buried. It's a feud that is dividing the dos Santos family, a cross-continental dispute over where the late former president's final resting place should be. Dos Santos's widow, Ana Paula, along with Angola's current president, João Lourenço, want his body brought home for a state funeral and burial. His daughter, Welwitschia dos Santos, wants a private funeral and burial in Spain for her father, where his children can visit. It's now up to a Spanish court to make the final decision. Dos Santos was a towering figure in Angola and across Africa, where many saw him as a giant in the continent's struggle for liberation. At home, on the streets of the capital, Luanda, Angolans reflected on Dos Santos's life and legacy.
For me, it was sad because it's the former president. So there is no way not to feel sorry. I'm very sorry for the death of the ex-president. It's sad.
When I was born, I'm about 30 years old. He was already president. He did good things. He also naturally made huge mistakes. But his death made me feel sad.
I think he did a lot of positive things for Angola. He changed a lot of things in the country, and I have good memories of him. These days, we are always hearing about the bad things he did in Angola. But I really think he did it for the best.
Dos Santos came to power in 1979, 4 years after Angola gained independence from Portugal. Supporters remember him as the architect of peace negotiations that ended Angola's long-running civil war in 2002, a conflict that lasted 27 years and ravaged the country. He oversaw Angola's recovery from that war to become one of Africa's biggest oil producers. However, Dos Santos's critics say he was a shrewd operator behind the scenes who suppressed dissent and distributed the nation's oil wealth among army generals, family and friends, while leaving ordinary Angolans among the poorest on the planet. Dos Santos stepped down in 2017 in favor of his hand-picked successor and defense minister, João Lourenço. But before his exit, Dos Santos pushed through a law that gave him immunity from prosecution for any crimes that he is alleged to have committed. Despite being from the ruling People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola, or MPLA, Lorenzo quickly began probing allegations of multi-billion dollar corruption during the Dos Santos era, targeting his predecessor's adult children. Dos Santos's son, José Filomeno, and daughter Isabel, said to be Africa's richest woman, are both under criminal investigation. Meanwhile, Angolans go to the polls on August 24th. President Lorenzo is seeking a second term as he faces off against Adalberto Costa Jr., leader of UNITA, Angola's largest opposition party and former rebel movement. Well, now for a deeper look into Dos Santos's life and legacy, I'm joined in studio here by João Santa Rita. He's a VOA Portuguese service reporter and editor. And joining us via Skype from Johannesburg, South Africa, is Marissa Lorenzo. Thank you so much for joining me, both of you. And João, I'm going to start with you. Now, we see this saga around Dos Santos's burial. We also see accusations of attempted murder in the mix. Please help us understand the family dynamics at play here.
Well, as your report said, I think what's at stake here are the investigations that the João Lourenço government has launched. José Eduardo dos Santos, you know, governed with a system of patronage, and his children, or some of his children, were some of the beneficiaries of this system. So the government has launched a series of investigations against Isabel. José dos Santos, which has been the most vocal voice in this dispute over the body of José Eduardo dos Santos, she says that her accounts in Portugal and in Angola have been frozen. And there have been reports that they want some sort of a deal with the government about an amnesty on these investigations to allow the body to return. Now, José dos Santos told us that this is not true. What's happening here is that they want an apology from the government, an apology about these investigations. The government has said through a high member of the presidential office that they regret that the body of the former president is being used as a bargain chip. So this is the stage here. Now, I must say that José Eduardo dos Santos had a lot of children. He has about 10 children. And the group that we hear about is a small group. It's José dos Santos, Isabel dos Santos, Filomeno dos Santos, and Coriandu. This is a group that has signed the letter to the government imposing certain conditions for the return of the body. Of course, this is, you know, this is very, it doesn't look good, you know, where the man is dead but he's not buried, you know, and there's this dispute. So I can go on until with what's happening in the Spanish courts if you want me to go into that.
Well, this is what I want to get at. I mean, first, looking at the election coming up, and you're saying the optics here are not great, no. Right? But what does his body coming back to Angola and being buried there? Is there some political capital here for the MPLA?
Yes. What's happening here is that the MPLA, I must say, remains united. But there are a number of people that were closely associated with the president that were also subject of investigations, not only his family, but, you know, like a General Copelipa, a very high figure during the Dos Santos government, General Dino. They are all under investigation. There's also the possibility of the former vice president, Manuel Vicente, being subject to investigations. So what the burial would do, a state funeral at this stage, would give the optics to João Lourenço of a party united. Now, this is, of course, being put at stake because of this dispute. But I must say, this is my opinion, I don't think that this is going to affect greatly the MPLA as it stands for the elections. I think the MPLA will remain united, but as you say, optically, this doesn't look good at all. You know, when you have a former head of state, the body being the subject of these disputes, right, it doesn't look good.
Well, speaking of the former head of state here, Marissa, can you give us a picture of how Dos Santos has really shaped Angolan politics and society, and how that will play a role in the upcoming election, or will it?
I think because DeSantis presided over one of the most unequal economies in Africa, despite the oil boom, he leaves behind, as you've already alluded to, quite a complex legacy. You know, on the one hand, his role in the liberation struggle is greatly respected. But I think that since Lorenzo took office in 2017, his role in history has been slowly minimized. You know, we've seen the names of buildings and streets that have been, well, that were named after Dos Santos, those have been changed. So we've sort of seen, you know, his legacy kind of, or, you know, his role in liberation just become more and more minimal. And I think that because Angola has, well, because the economy has been going through such a difficult time for the past 5 to 6 years as well, a lot of that blame is laid at the feet of the Dos Santos administration and the corruption that went on. So again, leaving behind a very complicated legacy. And actually, when it comes to the elections, Lorenzo will want to distance himself from that, because when he came to office, he promised a new, reformed, better, more transparent Angola. So now he's had a little bit of a struggle in wanting to honor Dos Santos, of course, you know, as the leader of the party for so many decades, but also not wanting to align himself too closely with the regime that he said that he's trying to fix and clean up after years of mismanagement.
João, Dos Santos, the man, is quite a complex character himself. As one finds is the case with most freedom fighters and freedom liberation movements, especially in southern Africa, we got a little bit of a picture of his legacy inside the country, but what is his legacy on the international stage, and what was the greatest impact he made there?
Well, internationally, I think his great impact has been the agreement that he signed with South Africa for the withdrawal of the Cuban troops from Angola. This, the presence of about 30,000 Cuban troops was, you know, a source of great controversy, if not instability, in the whole continent. So he negotiated the withdrawal of the Cuban troops, and in those negotiations opened the way for the independence of Namibia, because this was an agreement that involved South Africa, that also had troops in Angola supporting UNITA, and of course was in Namibia. So I think that was the greatest impact of his. Of course, Angola too was a regional power, and you know, it had great influence on what was happening in the Congo, and nowadays the Democratic Republic of Congo, then Zaire, you know, where his relationships with the then President Mobutu were not. Angola then supported some rebels in then Zaire. So, but his main impact was this, was the withdrawal of Cuban troops and the independence of Namibia, which led to a first peace agreement with UNITA, which then didn't last long, but that's another story.
Well, Marissa, we just spoke about the man. I want to ask you about the movement. How would you describe the state of the MPLA today in a post-Dos Santos era? And what is his legacy inside the party?
So there are definitely still some pro-Dos Santos loyalists that have still remained inside the party and serve as a weight to the kind of reforms that Lorenzo has tried to push through. But certainly Lorenzo, and I think we can see this more and more now as he reaches the end of his first term, he really has managed to consolidate his authority. He's not totally secure in his position, but he does exercise a lot more authority over the party than he did, say, 2 to 3 years ago. The MPLA itself, I think it is struggling more than it has, you know, in Angola's post-independence history. And that's purely because socioeconomic conditions have really declined in Angola, which, of course, is already very unequal. And there's a lot of people crowded into cities, around 65% of the population. And, of course, you know, when all this frustration builds up at the government, it starts to be directed towards the MPLA. And with Lorenzo having drawn a lot of attention to the corruption that went on during the Dos Santos years, while this has been a good thing in sort of showing, you know, that he's tried to clean it up, it's also facilitated a lot of anger towards the MPLA for saying, well, you know, how could members inside the party let this carry on for so long?
João, about Lorenzo's anti-corruption drive, first of all, tell us, how did we get to the point where José Eduardo Dos Santos, being the political, force that he was, how did it come that he picked a successor who then would go after his own family. And how successful has that anti-corruption drive really been? I mean, other than going after Dos Santos's family.
Well, let's start by the last point about the anti-corruption drive. There's great unhappiness about this, but I must say, you know, as someone who follows Angola daily, that there has been a lot of... we talk about the big figures. We talk about Isabel dos Santos, José dos Santos, General Dino, General Copelipa. But at the mid-level, at the provincial level of, local authorities, there's been a big clean-up. I mean, there's been a lot of people that have been arrested or dismissed for corruption. Now, what he said is that it's not enough, that there's still a lot of corruption. Another criticism is that there's still a lot of contracts, government contracts, that are being given, especially lately, by the government of João Lourenço, to companies associated with power, let's say, without any tenders. So this has been a source of controversy. Now, your first point was about...
how we got to the point that DeSantis would choose such a successor.
João Lourenço was, this is, again, another criticism, is that João Lourenço is... he's a man who comes from the liberation struggle. So he's a man who knows José Eduardo dos Santos very well. And there was a period in Angola where he was sidelined. He was sidelined by José Eduardo dos Santos, put aside. Then he was sort of rehabilitated, came back. And why he was chosen, I really don't know. I think João Lourenço was a military man. And so he was seen as somebody who could guarantee some sort of stability. He was a general, so he could, guarantee some sort of security in this transition. And I think João Lourenço saw him as someone who wouldn't shake the boat. And, that proved not to happen. And I think for two reasons. I think there's a personal reason here, but this is my opinion, that João Lourenço was sidelined for a long time and he didn't forget that. And the other reason is simple. I mean, we all know that the government, this was a rich country, with a lot of poor people. So João Lourenço had to do something about this and to launch this anti-corruption campaign for two reasons: to clean the image of the MPLA and to weaken the base that could be a threat to his own power. And that was the family of dos Santos and the circles around that, because this, as I said, worked in the system of patronage. You know, you have a figure, and around that figure you have a whole lot of other figures that benefit from this corrupt system of patronage. So I think he had to take measures to weaken that so that he could guarantee the stability of his power.
And where have we seen that movie before? In many, many places. I want to bring you in here, Marissa. This sort of palace intrigue that we see inside the MPLA, how does that play out on the streets? Does it resonate with voters? And will some of this be part of what's top of mind for voters as they head to the polls in August?
I don't think that voters are too worried about the internal politics within the MPLA. And I think this is because when they go to the polls, they vote, for the party that's going to get the majority in parliament. They don't directly vote for the president. And that's a change that Dos Santos made when he changed the constitution. And so I think that because voters don't have a direct stake in that, they don't worry too much about what's going on. So I think that for voters, their issues are more with, what does an MPLA win mean for them? And if they have to get the MPLA out of power, how could their fortunes change? Are they looking at a different Angola, or how must Angola look going forward?
João, what does the MPLA look like compared to other liberation movements? And we do still have these liberation movements in power in Southern Africa, but compared to the ANC, compared to SWAPO, compared to ZANU-PF, in terms of the power that they still wield, how do they fare?
Oh, they fare exactly the same. Except, I must say, except for SWAPO. But, if you compare the ANC to the ANC, to ZANU, to FRELIMO, you see the same dynamics here. And now, I must point out something that Marisa was saying, and I think she's very right. People talk a lot about the social media in Angola, that everybody is talking about João Lourenço. Social media is a urban phenomenon and very, very limited. I mean, in Africa, as we know, the internet and social media, it's not widespread. So I think Marisa is very right in saying that, this dispute, people talk about it, about the body of of Eduardo dos Santos, but it's not going to have a great effect. But going back to the MPLA, I think that the dynamics are the same. And I must say something here, that the same happens in Mozambique with ZANU and perhaps with SWAPO, I'm not very much aware, is that these parties have made something. Through their decades in power, they control every single level of state apparatus, from the top to the administration at the local level. It's all controlled by people associated with the party. There's no independent state institutions. So this makes it very difficult to change, and not only very difficult, but very, very risky, because how will these people react if the opposition wins?
And I want to get to this idea of the opposition, but I want to take a short break here, and we're going to continue this conversation on the other side. I want to look at UNITA, and I also want to look at what the challenges are, of course, for João Lourenço heading into the election. We'll continue our discussion here when Straight Talk Africa returns.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linor Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. We're discussing the life and legacy of the late Angolan president, José Eduardo dos Santos, and of course, what will be top of mind for voters as Angola goes to the polls on August 24th. And joining me here is VOA's João Santa Rita, and on Skype, we have from Johannesburg, Marissa Lourenço. Marissa, what are the challenges for João Lourenço heading into the August election? We spoke about the party stance and what's top of mind for voters, but himself as a leader, what are the challenges he's going to have to overcome?
Well, I think he's got two sets of challenges. The first comes from within the MPLA. So the dos Santos loyalists that are still there, they're not so much informed by their loyalty to the late president, but more the fact that they don't like Lourenço's reforms. Corruption risk is still quite high in Angola, but Lourenço has made some sort of positive changes. And what's happened in Angola, because the political elite and the business elite overlap so much, they've found it a lot more difficult to operate freely. And they don't really like what Lourenço has done. They don't like the scrutiny that he's brought onto the country. And they are worried that this is going to lose them votes. They're worried about how they're going to operate in terms of commercial contracts and things like that. And so Lourenço faces this challenge of, you know, there's parts of the party that like what he's doing and believe that it's very necessary because of the economic situation. But there are still these figures in the party that really essentially would want to challenge his authority and have a leader that will once again centralize power within the presidency, like dos Santos did, and not try to decentralize it, which Lourenço has not done to a huge degree, but he has sort of started that process. And then the second set of challenges really comes from below, where Angola was in a recession between 2015 and 2020. That's a long 6 years. And then, of course, like every other country, it was hit by the pandemic. And now it's been impacted again by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. So it's, people are fighting with rising living costs. And again, because you've got one of the most unequal societies, you've got people crowded into cities, these problems are very real, they're very acute. And Lourenço not being a very popular figure and the MPLA declining in popularity, it's going to be a challenge to convince voters that the MPLA can actually improve their standards of living, which have never been great for most of the urban poor, but now have really declined in the last 2 to 3 years.
João, tell us a little bit about Lourenço's main rival here, Adalberto Costa. He became the leader of the party pretty recently, but the party itself, of course, dates back to almost day one for the country. So tell us a little bit about him. Who is he? What is his background? Because I don't think we really have a very good picture of who he is.
Okay. Adalberto Costa Jr., I must say, is sort of a transition to a new generation. UNITA, for a long time, had as its leaders, from the president to the others who succeeded, Jonas Savimbi and the other ones who succeeded, all, there were all people who were involved directly in the civil war. And Alberto Costa Jr. didn't. Although he was with UNITA very early, he was in Portugal as a student, and he joined the MPLA as a member of the youth wing of UNITA in Portugal. Then he rose steadily. You know, he became a representative in Portugal. He then became a representative for UNITA in Italy, so always in Europe. Then he returned. He went to Parliament. He became a spokesman for the MPLA. Then he became deputy head of the parliamentary group of the MPLA. And finally, he ascended to the presidency. So you see a steady man who goes step by step until he reaches the top. Now, this has also provoked some divisions, not many, but a few divisions within UNITA, because, as I said, it doesn't come from that wing, let's call it, that was involved directly in the war. Secondly, which, you know, has come also mentioned, is the racial problem. Adalberto Costa Jr. is of mixed race, and there's been indirect allusions to this. I remember in the beginning when he was elected, there were accusations that he was not Angolan, he was Portuguese. There was a big problem because he had Portuguese nationality and Angolan nationality, and the court said, the Constitutional Court said that he had not annulled this Portuguese nationality before he became leader of the party. So there was being problems about this, allusions to this, and even the president, João Lourenço, in a recent speech made an allusion to that, which didn't, came out very well, because the symbol of UNITA is the black cockerel, and João Lourenço in a speech said that UNITA was no longer the black cockerel, it was the white cockerel. So there's been this kind of allusions, but I think Adalberto Costa Jr. is very popular. I think he's a popular man among the younger voters, because, you know, and he's a sophisticated man who can address audiences, and at the same time is very good at speaking and at arguing with you. So, this is Adalberto Costa Jr.
It's interesting. We saw some of the sort of race and nationality dynamics also play out in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Marissa, does Alberto Costa Jr. represent a different kind of politics, a new era? I mean, as we just discussed, he doesn't come from the sort of liberation hero class of the party. But what does he offer voters that João Lourenço, and let's face it, when it comes to age, João Lourenço isn't exactly long in the tooth, but what does he offer that the other side doesn't?
I think his approach has been quite interesting, because what we usually see with former liberation movements turned opposition parties is they tend to close ranks and they don't want to let anyone in. And, you know, what he's done in the lead-up to these elections is he's actually invited people that are not from UNITA to come in and take up top leadership positions. And this is quite a modern strategy. And I think it just shows that UNITA is trying to become a little bit more strategic in how it tries to topple the MPLA. Where it falls short, I think, is that it hasn't articulated its policy direction very well in campaigning. So, of course, UNITA has several seats in parliament, and there, you know, it's very active and very vocal. But when it comes to actually campaigning on the ground, you know, from what we can gather is that essentially UNITA's sort of more in the center-right, and we wouldn't really expect a big departure from how Lourenço has guided the economy, especially with the recent improvements that we've made. But in terms of what he offers, I mean, I think essentially it's more about optics. He offers a sort of vision and a hope for the future that he can be more in touch with young urban voters, because, again, like I obviously said several times, Angola has a very high urbanization rate, but it's also got a lot of young people. And I think the average age at the moment is 16 years. And I think that he will be able to better resonate with that kind of new generation. But in terms of actually tangible or a very different kind of leadership style or a very different way of directing policies or the economy, they wouldn't be too much of a change. I think there's also the hope that he would allow civil society to operate without so many impediments, that he would allow for more media freedom and things like that. But in terms of how that would play out, it would be quite difficult to see, just because we haven't really seen UNITA in governance.
Yes, she's absolutely right. And this is the problem, has always been in Angola, and not only in Angola, is that you know, the opposition is the opposition. You know, he's always against, talks about corruption of the MPLA, bad governance. But what is their program?
Right. Easier to say what you stand against than what you stand for.
And, but she's also right, is that he in fact has invited other people to join the party. And this is very important, join the party, join the coalition, let's say. And this, I think, is very important for Adalberto Costa Jr. There's one problem about here, about the young voters, is that there's been accusations that the registration of young voters has not been that good. So we don't know how many of these young voters were left out, and we also don't know what, you know, in terms of abstention, what's that going to be. And I think UNITA needs a lot of younger voters to go to the polls. We don't know if all of them are registered, and so they don't want an abstention. Now, in terms of what's going to happen, you know, I still see it very difficult for UNITA to win, but what I see is that I think the MPLA is going to lose a lot of seats. That I can see that, yeah. And that's why they don't want regional elections, because they know if there are regional elections city by city for municipalities, they're going to lose power in a lot of cities.
That sounds a lot like what we're seeing happening in South Africa. Marissa, just very briefly, what is your take on the chances of UNITA? Because it would be really monumentous if UNITA were to come to power. But what is your take on who really is the front-running party here?
So I completely agree with Strong. It would be very, very difficult for UNITA to win. I think that the MPLA's popularity has definitely declined, but we mustn't lose sight of the fact, you know, that it has huge organizational and financial capacity, you know, to campaign during elections. It's well experienced, you know, it's done this so many times before and been so successful. UNITA, I think, is changing and it is modernizing, but I think it still has a way to go. So for me, I see the MPLA coming out as, you know, with the parliamentary majority, which will then allow it to install Lorenzo for his second term as president. But again, like Jean said, losing seats in parliament, I don't expect it, you know, that it will get more than, you know, probably 50-odd-something% of the vote.
Do you think that we're going to see good turnout in Angola for this election, especially like what you mentioned earlier with the registration problems amongst young people?
I hope so. You know, it will depend how things go up to then. We don't know. But I think the parties are going to make a big effort to get people to the polls. I mean, we're already seeing that appeals for people to go out and vote. So I think that will happen. But, you know, again, as Marisa says, it's going to be very difficult. I mean, the MPLA controls all levels of state, you know, from the media to... So, you know, and there's always been accusations of cheating. So, you know, we'll see.
Well, it's always interesting to see how opposition parties do in southern African countries, especially where liberation movements still hold a lot of sway, although in some places their support is waning. But I do thank you so much for your time, João Santa Rita from VOA and Marissa Lorenzo. Thank you so much for your perspectives and for joining me here on Straight Talk Africa. And that is where we will leave it for this week. Thank you so much to our guests who joined me today, and a huge thanks to all our affiliate stations who always help us bring you this show across the African continent. And thank you to you, our audience, for joining us on television, radio, and online. Thank you for always watching, and thank you for always listening. I'll see you next time. Until then, it's goodbye.
from around the world. Let's go.